Welcome back to another episode of Out of the Blank Podcast. Hope, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show and back so soon because you started getting, I guess, super interested in Howard Hughes since our last discussion. And what happened? Did you just come across one of his books? You decided to pick up an interest?
I did. I'm in debt to this book, the ultimate book, which is called Howard Hughes, The Untold Story. And I'm sorry, I can't remember. There are two authors, but it's excellent. It's really exhaustive. The thing is that it was written in the 90s, and I think there's more medical stuff since then. But they did a really good job of uncovering, they did a million interviews, and they did uncover a lot of previously unknown information about his activities, especially his espionage, because he was a world-class spy who, spied on his girlfriends, but much earlier than anybody I think had known before. And then, more about his crashes and injuries. So you tell me where you want me to start. Should we start with Hell's Angels?
I mean, if you want to start with Hell's Angels, we can. I mean, does it just focus on his older, like, there's two Howard Hughes. What I would call, there's Hughes and then there's Howard. Howard's the later version where you start seeing the kind of expense, excessive spending and kind of the more Las Vegas style. And then Hughes is kind of like his family name, which I would consider his early life, which I didn't know. He was a part of the Boy Scouts and his mother. That's where the germophobia stuff really starts kicking in, because his mother, like, I think she stayed near the camp and was sending letters that you can look at the Library of Congress. She was sending letters to the actual scoutmaster saying that if he ever gets hurt, if he ever sneezes, he ever coughs, you let me know immediately and I'll be down there in a second.
Yeah, she was a major germaphobe, and their relationship was very sick and unhealthy. And it was a psychiatrist, I guess they did a forensic psychiatric report on him. And he said it was psychologically incestuous or something like, or emotionally incestuous. So like, it wasn't physically incestuous, but it was inappropriate. The closeness was inappropriate, particularly as he got older. Fortunately, she died before she could inflict any more psychological damage on him. But of course, by then the die was cast. He was a major germaphobe, as was she. But, also, I don't want to let his father off the hook. If his father had been around, none of this would have happened. His father was, apparently he was crazy about Howard Hughes' mother, but then he was also a massive womanizer, which his son inherited. And so he was off with other women all the time and then working all the time. And because he was in the oil business, he had to travel a lot. So she was alone with him all the time, like stuck in the house because she didn't want to let him out. And he couldn't like play with other kids because they were germy, And even after he learned to ride a bike, which I'm kind of amazed she let him do, he could only ride a bike around the driveway. He could not go to the creek with the kids and have fun, So it was really pathetic because he was this little Lord Fauntleroy of Texas who was just riding around in circles in his driveway. So it was a weird situation. But the other thing, okay, this is the other reason he got weirder and weirder, was that he was deaf. And I always thought that the deafness came from the plane crashes. It didn't. He was congenitally deaf. Yeah. And so it started, he was already hard of hearing when he was in his teens, and he wouldn't do anything about it. And he was very sensitive and vain about the whole thing. So he probably saw doctors who wanted to give him hearing aids, and he didn't want that. And then when he was with Billy Dove, who was this great silent film star, they went to Europe in 1930 or so. And this is when they were going to get married. So they were on a pre-honeymoon. I think they pioneered the pre-honeymoon trip to Europe. And she took him to this famous clinic to get him diagnosed for his deafness. And they explained to him that, the bones in his inner ear were growing and would continue to grow. And there was nothing he could do about it. He was going to get deafer and deafer and deafer. And he also had tinnitus at the time, by that point, which is really annoying. They said, you've got to get hearing aids. And they fitted him. And he was like, no way, I'm never going to wear hearing aids. So they said, well, you're just going to have to learn to read lips. And, he did to a certain degree, but that only goes so far. I mean, today he would have learned sign language and the people around him would have learned sign language. So he had this profound inability to connect with people because he couldn't understand what they were saying unless they were right up close to him, and he was staring right at their mouths. And so it made him incredibly paranoid because he thought people were talking about him and people were laughing at him. And deafness, and they say that the leading cause of isolation and depression in old people is untreated deafness. And the minute people get hearing aids, they're much, much better because they can interact with other people and they can be part of the world. But he was already isolated by the time he was in his 20s. And then the other thing, he was always flying and he loved flying, but there was another element to it, was when he was flying, the drone of the engines blocked out the tinnitus. So he no longer had this ringing in the ears because he could hear the drone of the engines and he could feel the drone of the engines. And it was very soothing to him, and he felt more normal. And of course, he felt free when he was flying. So that's why when he would meet women, he always took them out. Like usually on the first date, they were flying. And that was when he was the happiest and he was at his best. And he just loved it. And they loved him for it. He was so magnetic and charming. And who doesn't want to be flown to Catalina? Or he would also, like when he got the constellation, he would fly his dates to the Grand Canyon and hover over the Grand Canyon at sunset. So it was a baller move. I mean, that, who doesn't love that kind of thing? And so all of his dates involved flying because that was the one place in the air that he felt normal. And his ears, his deafness wasn't a problem because you can't hear above the roar of engines anyway.
Do you find that through doing your research, you've learned to understand, like the reclusiveness, for instance, is not so out of the norm when you understand that he kind of isolated himself at a young age, or he was isolated at a young age? It just seemed like it would be more normal. The reclusiveness would just be an average thing for someone who wasn't able to experience friendship or really able to experience life and going out there because there, whether it was a fear of germs or not. But then you have the, I guess, the romanticism. I mean, he's known as a playboy. And some books kind of paint him in a wrong light. But once you kind of understand, like, I mean, his perception on things, maybe you understand Howard a little bit deeper than most people do.
Well, what was interesting was they interviewed all these women in his life, and without exception, they all said he was incredibly charming. And I was like, why? He seems like such a weirdo. But apparently he loved talking. And he was a good listener too. So they would have these long conversations, and he had an amplifier on his phone. So what he really liked to do was to talk for like 4 hours at a time. I mean, that would drive me crazy, but I guess a lot of women like to talk on the phone. But men don't normally. So this guy was a unicorn because he loved to talk and he loved to talk on the phone. And he was very supportive and he wanted to hear all about your day and, all these things that women are always complaining that men don't want to hear, But he loved these long conversations. And he was, very handsome and very tall. And, women love that. But he was also very charming. And I think he had this kindness about him. And this is, this has to do with being raised by a woman. He understood women. And even though he was later very cruel to them and didn't behave well in a lot of cases, and that might have been the brain injury talking. But early on in his life, he had a knack with women, and it was because of his relationship with his mother. So that did serve him well, and women really responded to it. They hadn't met a man like Howard Hughes who was really, really responsive to women and wanted to talk to them and wanted to listen to them and wanted to spend time with them. And then, but the weird thing was that he was also this like weird, sneaky spy who was a womanizer. So he would like run out and, like simultaneously go out with another woman. I mean, and I'm not talking at the same period of time. I'm talking about on the same night at the same time, he'd have a second date. So he'd say, gotta go, I've gotta take a phone call. And then he'd be like, and he did this one New Year's Eve at the Beverly Hills Hotel. He decided to do three dates simultaneously. And it didn't work because they found out, but he had one of his dates in the polo room, polo lounge, and he had one in the main dining room, and he had one in a bungalow. And he would run back and forth between them during dinner. And he thought that was great, except that I think one of them was Terry Moore, And the other, and then the one in the bungalow was Jean Peters. And I can't remember who the third one was,
Oh, he
but
married Jean Peters.
he did marry Jean Peters. And I looked at pictures of her. She was lovely. She was absolutely beautiful, but I don't know why she stuck it out for 14 years because it was as she called it, it was a telephone marriage. They were rarely together. And then he would promise to marry her. And he promised to marry her for a long time because, you know, they met when she was a teenager. And that's how, you know, he was one of her stable of starlets. But then they did get married eventually. And then, you know, she kept saying, well, we'll get a house and we'll move in together. But it would be the same thing. Even when they were living down in San Diego, they did get a house, and then he wound up separating the house, and he had his wing, and she had her wing, and his wing was like a hospital bed in a darkened room. So it was, but he was constantly, I mean, to the very end, you know, he said, we'll buy a farm. And she was like, you know, she wised up a little bit, but she was incredibly naive about his lying and his intentions because I guess she was really in love with him, and she really thought that he was going to be a normal or relatively normal husband. And he was extremely deranged by this point. I mean, by the time they got married, he was in, you know, he was really in his paranoid hermit mode, you know, with the germophobia and all that. I mean, he wasn't wearing boxes of Kleenex for shoes. I don't think the Kleenex thing had started yet, but
It
he
didn't
was
start until the
definitely.
Desert Inn with the Kleenex boxes.
No, it actually started earlier than that.
Are you
But he
sure?
was on, yeah, it started earlier than that when he was still in. Oh, it was started when he locked himself in the screening room. Remember that from the
That's in
movie?
Vegas. That's the Desert Inn.
No. That was when he was in LA. So I thought it was Romaine, 7000 Romaine, which by the way has been was I met a few years ago at a restaurant. I met this guy and he said, do you know that building on Romaine, the one that used to belong to Howard Hughes? Well, I'm developing it. So they
Oh
actually,
my God.
yeah. So I don't know whether it's done yet, but they were going to make like condos out of
That
it.
was his that was what they called headquarters.
Right. But do you know what?
Yeah.
He had this major breakdown in the 30s, and that's when he locked himself in the room, in the screening room, and he was there for 4 months. Because he was trying to diagnose himself. He was trying, you know, he was really afraid that he was insane. And his solution was to, and this was when he was with Jean Peters. They weren't married yet, but he was with her and they were living at the Beverly Hills Hotel. So he disappears, they had separate bungalows, and he disappears from the Beverly Hills Hotel. And then he locks himself into this screening room, which I thought was at Romaine, but it was somewhere else. I think it was the Goldwyn screening room in Hollywood. And he did not leave, and he like nearly starved to death. I mean, he was so filthy that he wound up just being naked in a chair. All he did was watch movies and eat Hershey bars and drink milk. And he was there for 4 months. But that was when the whole thing, his aides would come and they would have to, you know, handle everything with 50 Kleenexes. So that was when that started. And then when he got out of that, I guess it abated for a while and then it got bad. When he was able to do that again, he thought that was a great solution for the germs.
Back to the locked when he locked himself in the screening room. You don't believe the urine thing, do you? It seems a little bit more.
No, it was weird because, well, he was peeing like against the walls of the screening room and on the floor because he had to be taken to the bathroom. So when they didn't get there fast enough, because somebody had to take him down the hall to the bathroom and open the doors for him with Kleenexes. And so he would just go ahead and pee on the wall. But the aides were the ones who were peeing in milk cartons because they were not allowed to use the bathroom because the bathroom was for him only.
That's interesting because the aides from the ones I've seen, they've all said that they denied the urine story, but it's just so weird because you can't tell what's real and what's not. Like if you ever look up Howard Hughes and there's a bunch of like sites that are dedicated to like gay history, and they talk about his childhood best friend Dudley Sharp, who did Sharp and Hughes Tool Company. Their fathers got together and created that tool company. Dudley's dad died early, but they remained friends for a long period of time. But on their website, they talk about there was a bit of romanticism between the two. And I'm like, I don't know what's like, they call themselves a history thing. Is that real? Is that fake?
I don't I you know this guy never made it into the book, and which I think
Dudley
is
Sharp.
exhaustive. Yeah, never made it into the book.
There's a good
And
book I would recommend. The one I sent you was Howard Hughes Empire, and then there's Howard Hughes His Life and Madness. And that guy his name's James. It's James Steele and Donald Barnett. It's two authors, but they've done extensive work on Howard Hughes, multiple various interviews with like Dudley Sharp was one of the people who like apparently after the World Continental flight that Howard did, the 94 hours or however he flew
yeah, the
around.
90-hour around the world flight.
He
Yeah.
called Dudley Sharp, and Dudley Sharp's in the military. You can look up his military profile. He's like a respected something, general or something. But he called, Howard had called Dudley after they hadn't really talked since he left Rice University after his father died, and told him that he like had this deep conversation with Dudley, talking about how he feels like he regrets a lot of things in his life. Like, this is not how he wanted his life to turn out to be. And Dudley's kind of like, you just went around the world and you're telling me, you're regretting your life decisions. What does that make me think?
Well, that was 1938. So by 1938, he was already, he'd already had a lot of issues in his relationships. He couldn't really have a relationship. His relationships with women are so weird because he was always getting engaged. Like he would have multiple engagements going at the same time. But he didn't want to get married. He was really afraid of getting married, and he had been married, of course. So his first wife was Ella Rice, whom he married very young. I mean, they weren't even, I think they were like 21 when they got married, and she's from a very wealthy family in Texas. Her family endowed Rice University. And but it was kind of an arranged marriage because he was pushed into it by his aunt, and she was pushed into it too, but she was crazy about him. And he couldn't stand her. He had no feelings for her. And she lived in LA, and oddly enough, they lived on Muirfield Road, which is a very nice street, and it's right in the neighborhood where I used to live. It's not far from here. It's in Hancock Park, and which is like the old money neighborhood of this side of LA. And so he lived on the golf course. So those these this road stretches by the Wilshire Country Club. So when you see the aviator and you see him landing the plane on the golf course and then going to his house, that is accurate. He lived in one of those houses that was right on the golf course, which I believe is still there. But so Ella would come out, and she just thought she was going to have a normal marriage to this guy in Los Angeles, and he would just reject her. I mean, he would make sure he never saw her. She had a very lonely life in that house on Muirfield, and then she would go, he would, then he just couldn't stand her so much that he sent her back to Houston, and she came back to try and try again, and she made inroads into Los Angeles society. So the her final act of trying to save this marriage was to give this big dinner, beautiful lavish dinner where everybody who was anybody was invited. And Howard, she cleared the date with him. He promised to be there. He didn't arrive until everybody was having dessert. And then he like rudely like wolfed down his dinner and then just walked out. And that was, the ultimate humiliation for her. But even that, after that, when she was back in Houston and she'd already filed for divorce, so Noah Dietrich, his right-hand man, called Ella after Howard had a, I guess it was one of his plane crashes. I can't remember which one it was because there were so many plane crashes, but he was injured and he was concussed again. And Deidre said, he's, was it that or something? No, it wasn't a plane crash. He was sick. He had some sort of mysterious illness and they thought he was going to die. And Dietrich said, you got to come. And so she got her trunk off a ship. She was sailing to France. So she and her sister or got their stuff off the boat, off the ship, and then they took the cross country train, which took 3 days to get to LA from New York. And they got off in Chicago, and by then Hughes was feeling better, and he sent like multiple telegrams to be delivered to her on the train saying, "Don't come, don't come, I'm fine." And she came anyway, and he was furious, and that was the end. I mean, I don't know why she bothered. I don't know what she was expecting, but she thought that this was going to be last ditch reconciliation, and he wouldn't even see her. I don't think he saw, maybe he saw her very briefly, but he was completely hostile, and he was furious at Dietrich for getting her involved in the first place. And I think it's weird that when you're not only, divorced, but you're getting on a boat or nearly divorced, you're getting on a ship to Europe, that you would actually change your plans for a guy who obviously didn't care. But she was a very nice lady. She was very refined. And Hughes screwed her on the divorce too, because they negotiated a settlement where he was going to pay her $250,000 every year for 4 years. So he wound up in terrible financial straits after that, because of Hell's Angels. And so he renegotiated the settlement, and her brother was a lawyer and was very clever and said, okay, you can pay through 1939. So he extended the payments, but he still didn't pay the full amount because, he was just able to kick that can down the road. And of course, the money became less valuable as time went on. It was not adjusted for inflation or anything like that. And the economy was so much better as the Depression abated, and Hughes was making more and more money. So it really worked out to his advantage that he didn't have to pay $1 million in the trough of the Depression. So but she was very nice, and she, was dignified about the whole thing, and she wasn't after his money. She really wanted to be his wife. So, but he was in love with Billy Dove. So he had already taken up with Billy Dove, and they had this storybook romance, and Billy Dove really loved him. But, he was cheating on her too, which he didn't think was a problem. I mean, he had this like secret hideaway house that was right within walking distance of the Muirfield house. So he would just duck out through the hedge and go, and he had like all these women there. They were like prostitutes or.
Why is he cheating so much? I don't get it. If he's like got the, I guess the instinct of a germaphobe a little bit, I would just think he would be wanting to be less around new germs as much as
Yeah, I don't.
possible.
It was weird. I mean, nothing really made sense, because the other thing is that he'd had syphilis, so you'd think that he'd really avoid these kinds of women, right? But and I guess he just felt that he was cured. I mean, I don't think he was contagious. I don't think he gave anyone syphilis after he went through the mercury cure. But it didn't leave him. I mean, he still had it, and that's what started to affect his brain. But yeah, he was really weird about his there was nobody that he didn't cheat on, and yet he was absolutely floored when women would become furious and leave him because of this, because he was such a philanderer. And he was like, well, what's the problem? He just didn't understand why that was a real betrayal. And he always, I mean, a lot of people think Billy Dove was the love of his life. He was never the same after her. They had a very intimate relationship, and she said it was incredibly romantic, and they were very close, and yet in the end she left him. And that was devastating. It was a big surprise to him. I mean, he's like, why? Well, yeah, maybe the fact that you have a whorehouse down the street has something to do with it. So it was really, and then he got really, really crazy with the women after that, as a sort of compensation. Then he was even wilder. And that's when the, spying started. I mean, I think that he might have even spied on Billy Duff. The espionage started earlier than people thought. People thought it was really like a 1950s thing, but or 1940s thing, but it actually started in the 30s.
To what extent was the espionage? I guess I'm not too familiar with it.
He would get people to spy on the women that he was interested in, and they weren't always his girlfriends. Often, like, he'd just see a woman and he'd be like, well, let's put a couple of private eyes on the case, and just they would just stake out her house and see who she was dating and see. And then of course this led to his bugging the place. So it, when in the by the time the 50s rolled around, when he had all these girls under contract, at one point 160 at a time, They were stashed all over Los Angeles. And he hadn't even met some of them, because how could you
Oh
possibly
God,
meet
that's what they called it.
160? Yeah,
No, there's a
160
story about one
girls.
of the girls. She goes, yeah, and look, I'm not making this language up. This is real, but they talked about they were called fuck pads. And that's literally what she, that's one of the girls called it that. She said Howard had a term for it, and that's what they called it. I didn't think it was real because it just didn't sound like anything eccentric.
Well,
It just sounded
not all, I mean, he
mean.
didn't even meet some of them. Some of them he saw newspaper accounts because they were beauty queens, or they'd won a contest for singing or
James
something like
Ellroy
that.
writes about this in American
Yeah.
Tabloid.
So he'd get them out there, but he didn't always, sometimes they would go years and they would never lay eyes on him. And he would interview them, sometimes he would see them. This is what the Warren Beatty movie was about. I think it's called Rules Don't Apply, which I didn't like, but that was about that time. And that was around the time Warren Beatty was a new, young up and coming actor in town. So he heard these stories, because there were so many of these women, and oddly enough, they didn't know, they had private lessons for years. I mean, they were getting singing lessons and dancing lessons and acting lessons. And for the most part, they had no idea that they weren't the only one. And there were so many of them. And so why did he collect these women, some of whom he never met, and most of whom he had nothing to do with, and who never got anywhere in their careers? But they stuck around, and they stuck around, and they stuck around, which was odd. You'd think that if somebody got you out here on a contract and they hadn't met you within a few weeks, you'd leave, right? Not these girls. And sometimes they were encouraged by their mothers, because they could come out with their moms, and their mothers were stage mothers in the making. But a lot of this has to do, I think, with the kind of people who are attracted to the entertainment industry. And years ago, I met the guy who was the head of he was the head of the mental health insurance division of SAG. So he worked for SAG has really good health insurance. And so he was a therapist, basically. And he said, there's a certain kind of person who it gravitates towards becoming an actor. And he said, they come out here and they live in poverty and they have four roommates, and all of a sudden they're 40 years old and they're still waiting, they're still going through pilot season, waiting for their big break. And he would tell these people, he said, listen, it's not happening. The big break is not coming. You're 40 years old, you have roommates, and you don't have a career of any kind. You have got to formulate a plan
It just
B.
takes that one call. It just takes that one call.
Yeah, and he would persuade some of the people, but the thing is that it's this highly unrealistic, I mean, you'd have to be unrealistic to think that you'd be one in a million anyway. But he said, these are people for whom, difficulty and humiliation it's normal to them, because they come from dysfunctional families, And I totally identify with this, because I have been rejected, my writing's been rejected, but it's never bothered me. A person who hadn't had adversity earlier in life and family adversity would find it unbearable. I kind of think it's been great. I mean, no one's been as rude to me in Hollywood as my family has been. And as mean to me. So, happy days as far as I'm concerned. But these actors are, they're in a situation where they can't afford the rent. And, their goal becomes, I want to work as much as I can to earn the minimum you need to earn in SAG to qualify for the health insurance. And it's not very much. It used to be something like 22,000 a year in acting jobs, but the average, and I think it's probably much more now, because this was in the 90s. So the average SAG actor, unionized actor, makes $44,000 a year. You can't live on that in Los Angeles.
No, not in
That's why they've
Los
got
Angeles.
roommates. I mean, I guess you could scrape by if you had like a, part-time job and roommates, but it's not enough money to live here. So this is the situation with these girls. They were very, very, passive about the whole thing. And some of them were like under contract and living in Los Angeles, taking lessons every day. And it wasn't like they had free time. Like, they couldn't date, they couldn't leave the house without permission. They had wall-to-wall lessons, and then they had to watch movies. They had to watch movies that Howard Hughes chose for them. So they had to spend like 4 hours a day
Oh
watching movies.
God, Washington Ice Station Zebra.
Yeah,
Jeez.
exactly. He loved that movie. But it was just weird how they had this very structured day, and they were like, "Well, when am I going to meet Mr. Hughes?" And sometimes they never did. I mean, it just went on and on and on and on. But he was it was and it was the same thing. Even women who were involved with him, like, really did know him and were his girlfriends and fiancés. They were very slow to catch on to the fact that there was never going to be a wedding, and he would fake marry people, which I think is hilarious because these women knew that they weren't legal marriages. Like, he'd take them, there's this cross up on the hill. He'd take them up to the cross and said, I'm marrying you in the eyes of God, right? Well, everyone knows that, unless you have some paperwork and a clergyman or a judge there, it's not a real marriage. But that was all these women. These were the nice girls who were religious. And so in those days, you didn't want to sleep with somebody that you weren't at least engaged to. And so he would do that, and he would have these fake engagements. And this went on. He loved being engaged, but he didn't want to be married. He was terrified of being trapped. And to him, marriage meant entrapment, even though he said he really wanted to be married.
Do you think that's why he never signed a will?
I believe he did sign a will.
You believe
And
the Dumas story?
I believe what?
You believe the Dumas story?
No, not that
Okay.
story. I believe the story that the book said, which was that Hughes was very into paperwork. And so he'd been writing wills since he was a teenager. And of course, his parents died young. So why wouldn't he be concerned about this? So he did have various wills, but the Mormons who were in charge of him at the end, who, by the way, murdered him, there's no question. He did not die of any natural cause. He died of like malnutrition, neglect, and a giant dose of codeine. And plus, on a normal basis, 10 times the allowed amount that you would ever be given by a doctor of codeine. So his fear of doctors, his fear of hospitals, allowed him to be abused and neglected and mistreated by these totally unqualified people who didn't even
Ooh.
treat his bed sores.
All right, you got to help me out with this one because this is an area that I haven't touched upon, but I've heard the other perspectives about it. Mostly I've heard kind of like the Howard Hughes, obviously they had an operations manual that would be directions on how you open up a can of peaches and how you deal with the hearing aid, putting it in a bag back and forth. Well, the aides kept logs too, and it would log every, like, we gave him this, what he called blue bombers, gave him this at this time and this time. But then Howard would be like, no, you didn't, give me another. And then they would give him another pill, even though they already marked it down. So now it says marked down, he's taking two pills. But who's going to say no to Howard Hughes? That's the one perspective I heard. Now, I have heard that the Mormons did kill Howard Hughes. I've just never looked into that area because it seemed more fringe to me, just because it's like murder and then it's like covered up. But if that's a real thing, please tell me about that because I'd like to know more about that.
Well, he was in Acapulco. So he was dying, and he was in a hotel in Acapulco, and they got scared, and they finally called this local doctor, a Mexican doctor who came, and he was horrified. He said, "This man is dying and he needs to go to the hospital right away." And they were like, no hospitals. Mr. Hughes doesn't want hospitals." And he said, "You have neglect." I mean, at this point, Howard Hughes weighed 94 pounds. He was 6 foot 4. He had advanced malnutrition, so he was starving, and he was in a coma. And they said he hadn't woken up in 36 hours. So he said, "Why did you wait? Why did you wait?" He said, "We can still save him if he goes to the hospital." He said, "Why isn't he on an IV drip?" They never gave him intravenous nutrition. They never gave him an IV drip. He was extremely dehydrated. So instead of doing that, they defied the doctor. The doctor gave an interview saying he died of neglect. So he was in terrible shape. I mean, his teeth were falling out of his head because of the malnutrition. He had, you know, he it was he had ingested nothing. He had no nutrition. He was extremely dehydrated. He had bed sores all over his back. And he oh he, it was so bad that his kneecaps were coming through the flesh. There was nothing left of him. So they got him on a plane, they flew him to Houston, and then they said he died on the plane, right? Very conveniently. Well, the autopsy showed that they had given him a massive dose of codeine. They had injected a massive dose of codeine that killed him, on top of all the codeine and other drugs that he was taking anyway. And they did it on the plane. And it's the highest recorded level of codeine ever in a human being. So it was, you know, exponentially, like 10 times more than, you know, you could ever give anybody at a single dose. And then when they did the autopsy, I mean, they uncovered all this other stuff, the hypodermic needles broken off in his arms, and the extreme malnutrition, and, you know, the bed sores and the neglect. I mean, it was just horrendous. But they didn't want him to survive. And the reason he didn't die of, you know, they said it was murder, was that there was nothing wrong with his heart and lungs. I don't know how, given the amount of drugs he was taking, but his lungs were clear and his heart was in really good shape. So he did have, they said, oh, he died of kidney disease. Well, he did have kidney disease, but his kidneys were still functioning and it wasn't as bad as they said. I mean, his kidneys were working. So he did not die of kidney disease. He had kidney disease. But it was, and the weirdest thing was that no one was ever prosecuted for this. What was incredible was there was the doctor who prescribed a lot of the medications did go on trial, but he was acquitted, or was fined or something. I don't think anyone ever did jail time. And the Mormon aides who really did want him dead, I mean, it was very obvious that they had been siphoning off money from Hughes for years. So they all had fancy cars and vacation homes, and they were flying around the world, and they had a lot of money that they had skimmed. So they didn't want that to become clear, but they were not prosecuted. And I think part of it was that the Mormon church protected them. And the doctor was in Utah too. And that's why he was acquitted at the trial. He should have gone to prison, but he was acquitted.
Do you remember the Clifford Irving hoax?
Yeah. Well, now I do because it was kind of a vague memory last time. And then I read about it, and this is
just
the thing about Clifford Irving.
Real quick before we get into that, Rob, he mentioned something to Hughes on the phone, if you believe it was Hughes. I believe it was Hughes. But he mentioned something on the phone where he talks about Robert Mayhew. He says, that bastard stole me blind. That's what you're mentioning when he talked about the Mormons. It was the Mormons and Hughes were siphoning, or not Hughes, the Mormons and Mayhew were siphoning off money from Hughes and taking advantage of him.
Right. Well, remember how he hired the Mormons in the prison. All the good people, including Dietrich, wound up being fired, or they left because of Hughes's Mormon coterie. And these guys, they were suddenly running the organization, but they had been drivers and bodyguards before. They had no particular skills. They certainly didn't have any financial skills. But the reason he hired them as bodyguards and drivers was because they didn't drink or smoke. And he liked that. Because except for a brief period early on, he didn't drink. And he thought that was a sign of moral rectitude. And so he trusted these guys. And I don't know why not drinking suddenly makes you trustworthy, but, you know, I can tell you it does not. Some of the worst people I've ever known were non-drinkers. Let me tell you about all the brain injuries since I did that part, right? Okay. All right. So we talked about 1928, the Hell's Angel plane crash. Skull fracture, concussion, broken jaw, metal shard in brain, which they didn't understand. And that was when he started to change his personality. He started to get very irritable after that and very angry. And he was in a coma. But he left the hospital soon after waking up and was on the set 2 days later. And people noticed the behavioral changes. He became much, much more temperamental, much more quick to anger. And then he also had migraines for the rest of his life and irrationality and memory loss because of that. So that was 1928. 1930, car crash on Pacific Coast Highway. He hit a granite wall. He was concussed and unconscious, woke up in a coma at Santa Monica Hospital and immediately ran out because he's terrified of hospitals. 1936 car crash. This is also really near my old house and pretty near my new house. This was at 3rd and Lorraine in Hancock Park, right near his house on the golf course. It was a foggy night. He had a woman with him. He killed a pedestrian who was waiting at the streetcar stop. The doctor said Hughes had been drinking, and the witness said he was driving erratically, not the one in the car, but another witness. And then Hughes' lawyers got him to recant the testimony and change his story to saying that Hughes was driving carefully and the man was in the street. So he had a concussion. He went through the windshield on that one and paid more than $200,000 in today's money to the man's family, the man that he killed.
Was he court ordered to do that, or did he do it on his own?
No, he did that privately so that they wouldn't. Ooh. Yeah.
Well, that's, so it sucks he killed somebody, but at least he kind of did that at least.
Well, it was $200,000 was nothing to him. He had gone through the windshield again. So he had lacerations. He had a concussion, untreated. He did get, I guess they took him to the hospital, but he ran out as soon as he
did
could.
They have seatbelts back then, or he just
no,
ride
are
without
you kidding?
One?
They didn't have seatbelts. Seatbelts were not mandated until the late 60s. And I remember my grandfather was angry about that because he didn't want to wear a seatbelt. But there were no seatbelts, and you know, there were no safety features on cars. They were like tin cans. So you were knocked around, and that's why people died so often in accidents. They really did go through the windshield. You know, they would be ejected from the car through the windshield. And that was what we just take seatbelts for granted, but you rarely have that happen anymore. The only time I ever saw an accident where somebody was ejected was this guy was driving a BMW convertible on the 10 and I was on the other side going west. So I didn't see the accident. It was done by the time I got there, but the seat ejected. So he was in a convertible, the seat ejected and he died. But that's, I don't know why. I mean, it doesn't really speak well for BMW that the seat would eject. But he wound up like, you know, crushed on the side of the freeway because of it. But you never really see that anymore. Okay, so that was that was 36. He probably had a couple more cars. And so with each brain injury, he becomes a worse pilot and a worse driver. And he becomes very reckless. And that's so it's kind of a snowball effect. You know,
maybe he thinks he can't die after all the stuff he's been through.
Yeah, and also the brain injuries that were untreated made him more erratic as a pilot and as a driver. So he was more, he had more and more accidents, more and more severe accidents because he made mistakes in judgment, and he was also really reckless. So now this comes to the 1943 Lake Mead crash of the Sikorsky S-43. So no one could have been better prepared for this. It was a seaplane. And Hughes, to prepare, had over the previous 6 months made 4,588 landings on Lake Mead. And here's the OCD kicking in. That's a crazy number of takeoffs and landings. There was no reason for it. But, you know, he loved the numbers, you know, just like he loved those 160 starlets. So he was extremely well prepared. But what happened was so this was a big flight because he had passengers, including an inspector from the Civil Aeronautics Administration. So there were four people besides Hughes in the plane, some of whom were his employees. So Hughes did not inspect the plane, and his mechanic had forgotten to load ballast into the tail of the plane. And so the plane did a nosedive because there was no ballast in the tail, and the propeller sheared off and pierced the fuselage of the plane and wound up embedded in the head of one of his passengers, whose name was Richard Felt. So Richard Felt, his head was sliced. He died a few days later. Klein, who was the civil aeronautics inspector, was knocked into the lake and his body was never found. So two people died. And then the rest were injured, and Hughes was very severely injured. It was his seventh major head injury. But he refused to be taken to a hospital because he was conscious. So he, and this was because he didn't want to be committed to a psych ward for his OCD. So he didn't treat that incredible head injury from crashing into the lake. So after this, the same year as in 1943, he wound up almost deliberately crashing a constellation, which was the TWA passenger plane. And he was flying it with a co-pilot because that was required. And he decided he was going to fully lower the flaps while the plane was flying at full speed, which sent the plane into a near crash. And it would have crashed if the co-pilot hadn't intervened. And he said, I just want to see how close we can get to crashing. Well, you know, this is crazy because this wasn't some little plane he was flying alone. This was a passenger plane with passengers on it. So then there was another car crash in 1943 where his girlfriend, Faith DeMerg, who was one of his, you know, teenage girlfriends, was very jealous of the fact that he was dating Ava Gardner. So she followed him and Ava to the farmer's market parking lot. And this is like a shopping center. It's still there. It's got lots of little kiosks and restaurants. And she repeatedly T-boned his car she could have killed Ava Gardner. So there was a lot of impact from that. He had a head injury from that, wasn't treated. Then in 1943, he repeatedly hit Ava Gardner and she threw a bronze bell at his head. She was a scrappy North Carolina girl and she wasn't going to take that kind of treatment. So he had a head injury, broken teeth, and a broken jaw. He'd already broken his jaw in the Hell's Angel crash. So his jaw was in very bad shape because I think it was shattered this time around. And at that point, his doctor said to Hughes that he was addicted to danger and psychodrama.
I guess it must be an adrenaline junkie, get the thrill from it all.
Yeah, he loved it. So, I mean, I'm sure there are car crashes I'm forgetting about, but we're going to get to the big one now, which was the 1946 XF-11 plane crash in Beverly Hills. So Hughes was definitely at fault here. There was nothing wrong with that plane, but he was cleared for a test flight over the desert, which he had no intention of doing. And he was supposed to be, it was supposed to be like an hour tops, right? So he takes off and he decides to fly back and forth over the most populated parts of Los Angeles. And he flies straight to Beverly Hills and then goes back along the coast and turns around and comes back and does this over and over again, to the point where he is 90 minutes over his time limit. And, you know, Noah Dietrich is begging him to come back. And when he finally decides, and he's almost out of gas I think he still has gas. Oh, he loaded twice the recommended amount of fuel into the plane too, so that he could fly longer. So it was just a crazy derogation of all of his responsibilities, because of course, you know, Hughes was only authorized to fly because he had done all this war work. So even though it was after the war, he was still, you know, supposedly under the control of the US government. And this was a test flight of a new plane, a very expensive spy plane. So this was a military operation. And he exceeded it. So he started to crash. And instead of cutting, he was trying to go to the Beverly Hills Country Club. And he didn't make it. He crashed short of that. But he could have crash landed if he'd cut the engines, and he didn't. So he was going full speed at a very low altitude over a very busy commercial and residential district of Beverly Hills. And that he destroyed three houses on Linden Drive because it was short of the golf course. And amazingly, none of the people in the houses were killed, but the houses were completely destroyed. So he was hitting roofs and, you know, the plane's wings were piercing into the houses themselves. And he was completely unbelted. I think there were belts in airplanes at the time, but he unbelted himself because he couldn't believe that he was having a crash that didn't involve something that he could fix. So he was looking around the cockpit to see if there was some kind of a mechanical failure. And it was pilot error, you know. It was there was really nothing wrong with the plane, but so when the plane crashed, he was banging around in this it was a glass cockpit. So he was smashing around in there, and he had 70 injuries. I mean, these were like noted by the doctors. So they included broken back, crushed collarbone, shattered ribs, shattered jaw, concussion, third degree burns, and lacerations to the face and body. And he was in a coma. And nevertheless, he left the hospital after 39 days, which is incredible. He should have been there for months, right? He even managed to have some plastic surgery while he was in the hospital. But, you know, he was given, I think, less than a 50% chance of surviving. Nobody thought that he was going to really live. And he did. But, you know, again, he had, and they knew they'd taken x-rays. They knew he had brain damage. But it really wasn't treated because the whole thing about having a concussion is that you have to stay in bed, you have to lie there and not move around. So he would jump out of bed and run out of the hospital. So his brain was rattling around in his skull.
You're not supposed to sleep either.
Yeah, well, that's true. He mean that you're supposed to have total rest. He should have also like been in a darkened room, you
I've
know.
had a concussion. It's not easy to not sleep, I can
Right.
tell you.
But even light is a problem when you have a
Yeah.
concussion. So he did everything bad. So he and so the, then of course, as I said, his syphilis got worse and worse because it was it they couldn't treat it while he was being treated for his life-threatening injuries. But he was also they also discovered at that point that he was allergic to that he was resistant to penicillin. Penicillin did not work on him anymore.
That's rough.
And yeah, and they didn't have any new antibiotics. So this is when the syphilis got out of control, and he by the time he got out of the hospital, he already had neurosyphilis. So, you know, that affects everything. I mean, it not only affects your judgment, but
Just a little tidbit on the crash. If you watch the video that they have on YouTube of the actual like houses and the footage of like Howard Hughes, aviator crashed here. But one of the houses of the guys that they mentioned is one of the prosecutors on the Nuremberg trials, which I just thought it was super interesting hearing that. I was like, no way,
it's
guys.
amazing that he survived. I think that they show that in the movie. He's in the house with his wife, and they narrowly escape getting, you know, sheared by one of the wings that has come into the house through the wall. But yeah, it was really, really, really bad. And of course, then the OCD was completely out of control. And the women were a part of this. Like the women were like a living exhibit of OCD symptoms, the collecting, you know, having to have them around to just to know that they were around made him feel less isolated and lonely and more in control of things. So it was weird. It wasn't like he needed to, you know, sleep with them or even see them or have a relationship with them. He just needed to know they were there, like dolls, kind of like a doll collection. So he so his wives were Ella Rice, and he, you know, he got married in 1925, so he wasn't even 21 then. So that was 1925 to 1929, and then Jean Peters, 1957 to 1961. But they rarely lived together because his germophobia was so bad, and so, you know, they were often like living in nearby bungalows at the Beverly Hills Hotel. But she was not allowed to live with him, so they just talked on the phone all the time. And I can't believe that she put up with that for as long as she
And they
did.
wrote letters to each other too.
They wrote letters, exactly. So he had this terrible fear of an abandonment. Oh, the fake marriage, the really big fake marriage he had was to Terry Moore, who was an actress who's still alive, I think. Or she might have just died. But anyway, Terry Moore, basically was one of these holdouts. She insisted on being married to him before she would sleep with him. And so he took her out on a boat, and married her. And he had somebody there. I mean, she was like, "Well, I don't know if it was a real marriage or not, because I don't know whether the captain who married us was really qualified to do that or something like that." But anyway, it was never there was never any paperwork, right? But it was good enough for her. And so after Hughes died, she went to court. There was a trial because she claimed she was his legal wife. And the court found that she was not his legal wife, but his heirs wound up giving her a large settlement. And here's the other thing is I was telling my dentist about this podcast last week, and she said, "Well, do you want to hear my Howard Hughes story?" And I'm like, "Well, I
What?
didn't know
No
she had
way.
one, right?" It's so funny. And she said she has these friends, and they were cousins of Howard Hughes, distant cousins. But they knew the family. I mean, they weren't that distant because they didn't have any doubt about their relationship to the family. And they said, "Well, he died. We should petition the estate." And they did, and they got life-changing money. And it was wonderful for them. I mean, it changed their lives for the better. They got a beautiful house in Holmby Hills, which is very expensive, and they got a lovely apartment in Paris. And they enjoyed it thoroughly. And I thought, how nice that they enjoyed this money that Howard Hughes could not enjoy. I mean, he lived in squalor and misery, and he was incapable of enjoying anything. And he spent, he died a horrible death. But these 100 or so heirs of his, at first I thought they were only going to be like 10 people, but they started coming out of the woodwork, and good for them. So there were 100 heirs. And they had life-changing money because these were multi-million-dollar settlements.
What would have happened to Howard's life if we would have understood more about mental illness and maybe what he was going through?
Well, it just to get his OCD treated. They like doctors who specialize in OCD said if he would have been completely cured for life in a year today. Because it's a syndrome, it's not a mental illness, it's a syndrome, it's biological too. And you can, they give you exercises to do, and you have therapy, and then they put you on Valium or some other kind of tranquilizing drug. So, you're not so agitated, and you don't have these compulsions to repeat your behavior. But it's something that you can be cured of. And you can cure yourself of it if you catch it early. I know because I did. I wound up with them. Okay, but no one knew what OCD was. I mean, I never heard the word, and it
Well,
was
I think everybody has a little bit of it when you're a kid.
it forced me, but I was pushed into it by a teacher of mine, and she was this like one of these people who should not have been teaching 7-year-olds. She was this battle axe, and she kept like screaming at us that everything was covered with germs, and we were dirty, and we were germy. And I was a very fastidious child to begin with, so this pushed me right over the edge, and I became a compulsive hand washer, like to the point where I couldn't sleep. And I had, but I realized that I had to do something. I had to stop this, and I just forced myself to stop doing these things because I was embarrassed about it. And it didn't take much. I mean, it just took my mother finding out about it. And she said, "What's going on with you getting up in the middle of the night and washing your hands?" And I was so humiliated that I cured myself. It took about 6 months. But, Hughes really thought that this was the mark of insanity. And it's OCD is one of these things that it can, I mean, it would, for me, it was definitely triggered by this teacher, because I was so clean to begin with, that there was no way to get any cleaner without, winding up washing my hands 50 times a day. And it was because of her. So it was a fleeting thing. The whole thing probably lasted 6 months. But, including, maybe a little over 6 months, including getting better. But Hughes didn't know. He was just ashamed, and he didn't know what was going on. And he really thought that his mind was deteriorating. And his mind was deteriorating, but it wasn't because of the OCD. It was because of the plane crashes and the car crashes and having things thrown at him and getting beaten up at one point by one of these boyfriends.
I had really you got to tell me that story, but I had OCD for like I think probably like a year. I was flipping light switches on and off, doing it an even amount of times, usually around 8 to 12, and then I would be doing other things in even patterns like that, and like just religiously. I don't know why, just thought something in my head was like, and it took one day at my grandpa's house. That was it. He caught me flipping that light switch 8 times. He goes, "Robbie, God damn it, what he's doing?" And I was just like, "I'm sorry, I can't help it. I'm just flipping the light switch." He's like, "Don't do it again." And he just like sat me down and like, I mean, sternest I've ever seen my grandpa look at me, and it snapped me right out of it. Didn't do it ever again.
That's the thing. You need somebody older, to a family member, to say cut it out, and that's all it took for me too, you know. But he didn't have that, you know. Hughes's big problem was he had the same problem that a lot of very rich people have, which is that nobody says no to them, and you know, so it isolates you even further because you're in an echo chamber. You're surrounded by yes men. They will always do what you want. I mean, you know, I don't know why anybody would have put up with his behavior. I mean, it was disgusting, like the peeing all over the place and the filth. But, you know, everybody w had their hand out. Everybody wanted money. And this, you know, kept him insulated. So everything, you know, money was really the root of his problems. I mean, if he'd been a normal person and he'd had to live in society and hold down a job, he couldn't have done any of this stuff. You know, he might have wanted to collect women or wash his hands all the time or, you know, lock himself in his room, but he wouldn't have been able to. So, you know, it's true. Money is the root of all evil, and it made him into an evil person, which is sad because all of these women in his life said that he was the sweetest, kindest, most romantic, loving man they had ever met, until, of course, he started hitting them and screaming at them and, you know, being mean to them. But, you know, a lot of that was the head injuries talking.
I want to end on the boyfriend story. I want to end on that. We got to get to that. That's crazy. What do you mean? Whose
Well,
boyfriend?
it was one of his, you know, girls, contract girls. And I'm sorry, I can't remember who it was. But it wasn't somebody super famous. But anyway, she was going to run away with him. And, Hughes had him followed and all that kind of stuff, and tried to intimidate him, and he beat Hughes up, and it was really bad because, you know, he wound up with another broken jaw, and his jaw was just shattered, and he wound up with another head injury because of it. And it
That's
was
rough.
really funny because, I mean, it was the only time anybody had ever really given him the licking he deserved, you know. So it was weird because all of his employees were secretly happy that somebody had finally, you know, made him see the consequences. And this was about the bugging and the spying and the constant surveillance and harassment of this poor woman. But it was a gilded cage, and it was very hard for these women to escape. But every once in a while, somebody did. But this guy was furious, and he beat up Howard Hughes.
Hope I appreciate all the research you've done and the interest you've got sparked up in Howard Hughes. That's
Well, you know,
awesome.
we could, it's the gift that keeps on giving. We could go on forever talking
I'm
about.
sure we'll do another podcast about it too. I could tell you that. I got to get some more research under my belt. I'm going to read the book you read so I can at least catch up on the same area that you're in on Howard Hughes. But it's
Yeah, it's exhaustive. I mean, I just, you know, it was, and I was listening to it too, you know, this is a very long book. So that's why, you know, I would take notes, but I couldn't get it all. So it's one problem with listening to things, but at least I get through these long biographies. But yeah, he was an amazing guy, and it's just sad the way he died. And that's why I was so happy to hear about these heirs that my dentist knows, because I thought, good for them, you know. It was life-changing, and they enjoyed it thoroughly, and I think they have every right to have this money and to enjoy this money that he couldn't enjoy.
is there a place where people can find your links, Hope?
It's hopeandersonproductions.com, and you can find my Substack links. You can find links to my films on Vimeo. You can order books and films that I've made off that.
The Silk King, right? That's the one I gotta
Silk
get.
King, Jim Thompson's Silk King. Yeah, because you
I
like
gotta get.
conspiracy, so you could read about that conspiracy. But that was my first film. So yeah, like, you know, next time I want to talk about something else besides Howard Hughes, I kind of feel like we could keep going on this, and maybe not in a healthy way.
Probably. I mean, Howard Hughes, I don't know. His like right now he's just captured every single aspect of my life right now where I'm looking at him like this guy has done everything. You can't tell what's reality and what's fiction. There's so many theories, and every time I keep learning something, I'm always learning something new, which is just interesting that I'm surprised a lot of people in my generation don't know who he is.
Well, he was amazing, but he did a lot of harm too. And, of course, and it was sad to hear that these plane crashes were really his fault. And it was a combination of his poor judgment because of the brain injuries and his and that's the thing, he couldn't organize his thoughts, so he wasn't rational. But it was also the fact that he was a daredevil. He became a bigger and bigger risk taker because of the brain injuries. But and people really, I'm really grateful to live in a time where doctors understand this because they did their best. I mean, he had a wonderful doctor who stuck with him for decades and really, really tried to help him. But there was a lot that they didn't know.
Well, Hope, I'm going to link all your links in the description. It's been a pleasure chatting with you
Okay,
again.
great talking to you, Robbie.
And thanks to everybody for listening to this episode of Out of the Blank Podcast. Stay tuned.